Welcome everybody to the Community and Regional Affairs meeting this afternoon. Today, we're going to hear a number of bills, and today we have present Senator Gary Stevens, Senator Albert Kukish, and Senator Joe Thomas, and myself, Senator Olson. We want to continue on with the public testimony for Senate Bill 161, which has to do with the Coastal Zone Management Program. The first person that we have to go ahead and testify is Skip Ryman from Yakutat. Mr. Ryman, are you on, sir?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Ryman, if you would give us your testimony, please, and state your name and affiliation, and give us your testimony this afternoon.
Yes, certainly. My name is Skip Ryman. I'm presently the borough manager for the city and borough of Yakutat. From December of 2002 through December of 2006, I held the position of borough planner, serving also as Yakutat Coastal District Coordinator. When the state of Alaska decided to participate in the Coastal Management Program, it chose to do so under a model that utilizes many separate coastal districts. As I understand the program, the state could have entered with a single statewide umbrella plan, but the realities of our state's diversity made it impossible to properly articulate concerns under such a single plan umbrella. Coastal concerns of the Northwest Arctic are radically different from those of the Southeast, which are in turn different from those of the Aleutians, South Central, Yakutat, etc. It was only my second district meeting when we learned that Governor Murkowski had chosen to eliminate DGC, the Coastal Policy Council, and centralize habitat and permitting within the Department of Natural Resources, actions that were described as streamlining and stated to be an attempt at making permitting less complicated for developers. As the administration's streamlining took further shape, it became obvious that it was the individual coastal districts that were viewed as impediments to development, and the muting and even the elimination of their voice in development issues was the goal. HB 191 was, I believe, an honest attempt on the part of the legislature to reduce bureaucracy and streamline permitting. The community of Yakutat does not believe it was ever the intent of the legislature to eliminate participation by the people of the state of Alaska in development issues. It does, however, believe that it was the intent of many of the regulations and their interpretation which followed on the heels of HB 191's passage. The attached position letter to OCRM on the draft environmental impact statement for approval of amendments to the Alaska Coastal Management Program, jointly signed by myself for the City and Borough of Yakutat and by Bert Adams for the Yakutat-Tlingit Tribe, documents that belief. SB 161 seeks to reestablish full participation by the people of the state in their affairs, and I have been directed to extend this community's support to the adoption of SB 161 and the reestablishment of the Coastal Policy Council. Thank you for your time, and also we've been trying to fax a written copy of my testimony along with a copy of the November 2005 letter mentioned in my testimony. You've been having trouble getting through on your fax machine. It should be coming shortly, though. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ryman. Is it true that we are having trouble with the fax machine?
Yes, we are. And
that'll be taken care of?
Yes.
We want to welcome Senator Wagner to the committee. Are there any questions of Mr. Ryman by any members of the committee? If not, we will go on to our next person to testify, and that's Marlene Campbell from Sitka. Ms. Campbell, are you on?
Yes, I am.
If you'd go ahead and state your name and affiliation for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Marlene Campbell, the Government Relations Director for City and Borough of Sitka. For 20 years, one of my responsibilities has been as Coastal Management Coordinator for the City and Borough, and I have been here for the entire revision process from the onset of House Bill 191 to the completion of our approved coastal plan this last spring. I can only thank anyone who has had anything to do with the development of SB 161, and especially sponsor Senator Olson, for the major step in the right direction as I see it as a coastal management coordinator. Our community used to be extremely proud of our Sitka Coastal Program as a responsive, supportive entity working with developers, but at the same time protecting the environment in our coastal zone. That relationship changed with the onset of House Bill 191 and further changed with the forced revision of our coastal plan to basically remove any effective policies relating to subsistence habitats or most of the other areas within our coastal plan that had been so helpful to us in the past in developing workable compromises for taking care of our local area, which is 4,710 square miles in the city and borough. So I want to thank you for your sponsorship of this bill. I strongly support broadening the public involvement for coastal district and public ability to comment on permits. That's especially true with the Department of Environmental Conservation, which is now reviewing air, land, and water quality permits with absolutely no contact with the coastal districts, as far as I know, with the public. The legislation requiring a public process for DEC permits where appropriate is just an excellent ability for the communities to reconnect with the permit process. I'd want to mention how important we feel the subsistence component is. Subsistence is measured and mentioned in our coastal plans, but we have not been able to promulgate any enforceable policies related to it effectively. I don't know if anybody in the state has really succeeded with that. The ability to reconnect subsistence with our coastal program and our coastal zone is so important to those of us, almost all communities, which feel strongly about these subsistence resources and uses. And with that, I want to thank you again for this excellent legislation and say that the Sikkim Coastal Program strongly supports it. Thank you for this opportunity.
Do we have any members of the committee that want to ask any questions of Ms. Campbell? If not, Ms. Campbell, I'd like to go ahead and ask you, is there going to be any significant development in your area of the coastal region that you have that you're responsible for?
Well, there is regularly development as far as large scale, such as a big mine or something. That is not, to my knowledge, in the immediate future. However, whatever development is occurring is pretty much occurring outside the ability of our coastal managers to comment effectively or public to be notified about. So I'm no longer really up to speed on what may be happening, and I think this legislation would go a long way to at least providing public notice of those kind of situations. We can certainly use some development around here, and as far as I know, it's pretty much small scale.
One further question, Ms. Campbell. Has the plan for your area been approved?
Yes, it has. It was approved in April.
Any further questions, Ms. Campbell? Not. Thank you very much for coming out this afternoon, Ms. Campbell, and we appreciate you, your testimony.
Thank you.
The next person that we have to testify is Marvin Smith. Mr. Smith, are you on, sir?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead and state your name and affiliation for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Marv Smith. I'm the Community Development Coordinator for Lakin Peninsula Borough, and I am the Coastal Coordinator for Lakin Peninsula Borough in that category.
Okay, go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I appreciate it. I support this bill very much because the biggest thing that this thing changes is that it reestablishes the Coastal Policy Council, and it puts the ability for the districts to have a say in what goes on with consistent reviews more than we do now. The present plan as it has does not include the air, land, and water quality. It's difficult to not include that when you're doing your consistent reviews properly in the states. And most of all, the local districts do not have the powers to adopt enforceable policies that are meaningful enough. As you can look at the old plan and the new plan and the number of policies that our borough had and the one we presently have, it's significantly different. And we want the opportunity to have a local input at the local level and write meaningful policies. We have development going in our area that's going to be detrimental to us. We want to have a local input. I think this the way the plan was when the revisions happened in the previous administration, it did not consider all the ramifications that could occur. I think that today is time, with the many things going on, our local governments are very important to us. Every community in Lake and Peninsula Borough is either located on the coastline of a freshwater lake or on ocean, all 17 of them. And that is very important to us. That's a livelihood. Fishing is very important to us, and we want the local communities to have input on how the coastal zone can be developed. And I think that this legislation starts in that direction by a lot. And I thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Do we have any questions from the committee for Mr. Smith? Mr. Smith, has there been any recent developments in your area or coastal management plan area that has been affected by the previous administration?
Recent developments, no, but we got a big one coming in the future.
And what kind of difficulties are we going to get into if we do adopt this bill?
What kind of what, sir?
What kind of difficulties do you see ahead if the amount of activity that I envision in the next 5 or 10 years, if we do implement this bill, Senate Bill 161?
I don't see any difficulties, sir, by changing this. I think that it would give the local governments opportunities to, have some say-so on how our local districts are developed and are what development goes on in them. The present regulations are, and in fact, our plan right now is not even in effect yet because we're trying to use a statewide standard when a coastal consistent review comes in front of us. Our recent planning commission, I presented them a project that was being that for review. I gave them the statewide standards and told them this is what we got to review this policy under, and they were simply said, their comment was, we need to go back to the old plan. And that was from our planning commission.
Okay. One last question. Has your plan been approved?
No, sir. Our plan is it's prevalent at the Office of Coastal Resource Management in Washington, D.C., waiting to be approved. They had to extend the time for being approved.
Do you anticipate it being approved? In the time frame that's been prescribed?
Well, they asked for an extension, so I don't know. I hope that's coming soon. We hope it's going to be approved, So I can't answer that question. The federal government in Washington, D.C. answers that question, sir.
Okay. Any further questions, Mr. Smith? Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, I'm trying to figure this out, being an outsider on all of the coastal zone management issues. But I guess when we look at what we had before House Bill 191, we had a council that was seemed to quite control things. After 191, now we have a department that seems to be running things. And what we keep hearing from communities like yourself is that you feel there is no forum. There's no role for local communities in policy development. So I guess what I'm trying to get from you, Mr. Smith, is there some middle ground? Are you suggesting that the best answer is to go back to the policy council we had before, or are you suggesting there's some middle way of including communities and still keeping the department involved? And so what I'm saying, I guess some of the testimony we've heard is that people have said they don't really want to change the day-to-day operation of the department. They just want to have a little more balance and to be at the table. Can you comment on that?
Yes, sir. Being at the table is very, very important. And as far as going back, I don't think we can go back. I think what we got to do is take what we got now and try to mold it into something that'll work for everybody, sir. And to go back, because it's taken us 4 years to get where we are right in our plan, and I hopefully it'll be approved very shortly. And that's been a lot of hard work. I think that we can probably, the present regulations maybe need to be tweaked a little bit. The real answer on whether or not we got to have a coastal policy council, I can't answer that, sir. I think that we just need, the coastal policy council was made up of a group of people from the districts who understood what happens in the communities and could convey those problems and relate those problems to the staff on how things could possibly work. I think that was a good working relationship. I'm not sure 100% that that will work, sir, but I think that having that local input from the local people who give that input to the DNR staff is a great asset. And I think that, you know, and previous to that, we also had what was called a working group that was there, and that's no longer done anymore either. And the rest of the reason hasn't been done because they've had such a turmoil of staff in coastal zone management. I understand that. But those people at the local level who can give those inputs to the staff are very critical to mold things in the right direction, sir. I hope I've answered your question the best I could.
Well, thank you, Mr. Smith. Yes, I think you have, and I think you're struggling with it just as we are. I'm not sure that this committee is the place to really go into all the details of how a council will be made up. And maybe that would take place at the Resources Committee, the next committee. So
thanks a lot.
I'd be in favor of passing this on to Senator Wagner and let him figure it out. But I sat on that committee, too. I think it is an important issue. I mean, I've heard both sides. I've heard the department. I understand what they're saying, you know, that often things got bogged down and they felt as if they had no control over the outcome. I understand what you're saying, wanting to be at the table, having some input, feeling as if there's a forum for the local communities to be involved. It seems to me that there is some compromise out there, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to see us explore that in the future. But I'm perfectly willing to move this out of this committee at this time.
Well, we've got a number of other people we need to hear from before we actually act on it, Senator Stevens. So are there any other questions of Mr. Smith? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Smith, for coming out this afternoon, and appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, and thank all of you for listening to me. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else here in the room that wants to go ahead and testify? Is there anybody else here in the room that or online that wants to go ahead and testify? If not, we'll go ahead and close public testimony for Senate Bill 161. At this time, I'd like to go ahead and call on Dan Easton, Deputy Commissioner of DEC, to go ahead and give us his perspective from the department on SB 161.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Dan Easton. I'm Deputy Commissioner at DEC, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee about the committee substitute for Senate Bill 161. My testimony will focus on what's known as the DEC carve-out. That's a provision of current law that would be removed by the bill. And I also understand that the committee is interested in our experience in conducting what are called single agency reviews. So I'll go ahead and speak some to that. I'll define and explain what that's about as well. And I guess finally, before I get to it, our testimony at this point is based on somewhat of an incomplete understanding of the bill. So the bill generates a number of questions for us. I'll identify those as we go along. And perhaps as these questions are answered, then, you know, our view of the bill could change. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I go ahead and start with speak for a minute about the DEC carve-out. The DEC carve-out basically has two parts to it. The first part is a definition that says that the DEC standards for air quality, water quality, and solid waste disposal, as well as spill prevention and response planning, are the sole enforceable policies of the Alaska Coastal Management Program for those purposes. So that's the first part. The second part says that when DEC issues a permit for an activity, that establishes that activity as consistent with those ACMP policies. So first part says that the DEC standards are the policies, and when we issue a permit, that automatically establishes consistency with those policies. So the effect of that provision is that project activities that require a permit from DEC are not subject to the ACMP process. They're carved out from the ACMP process. inherent in this provision of current law is this the thought that DEC has a duty to establish and interpret the state environmental standards, and that DEC would authorize only activities that comply with those standards. Because the state environmental standards are the only enforceable ACMP policies for those purposes, DEC authorization is both necessary and sufficient to establish consistency with the ACMP standards. Just another way of saying that. So again, that's the definition of the DEC carve-out. That carve-out's removed by Senate Bill, this version of Senate Bill 161. And I also mentioned that our authorizations typically include air emissions permits, their water discharge permits or certifications, pesticide permits, oil spill prevention and response, contingency plan approvals. When we issue one of those authorizations, those activities that we authorize, again, aren't subject to ACMP review, but they are subject to an administrative process of public notice, public comment. And then our permits and our permitting decisions are subject to both administrative and judicial appeals processes. So it may not be an ACMP process, but it's not a closed process either, our permitting processes. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman, on the carve-out and turn to the committee's interest in single agency reviews. When DEC is the only permitting authority for a project, then it's up to us to determine whether that project needs to go through an ACMP review. Again, the parts of the project that are subject to our permits, those are carved out. But any project could include other parts that would be subject to an enforceable district policy, and it's up to us, or it requires us to look at that project and make a decision with DECOM as to whether there are parts of the project that should be subject to a local district review. We have internal guidance that tells us how to operate this process. The first step starts with we send a letter to the local coastal district after we get an application. That letter includes a copy of the permit application along with other project information, and ask the local coastal district to identify any enforceable policies that it has. At that point, the project can go to one of two ways. If there are no enforceable local district policies, then there's no ACMP review. If the local district says, yes, we have enforceable policies and we agree with that, then we, DEC, will actually subject the project to an ACMP review for the purposes of deciding whether or not these other parts of the project, those beyond our permits, are comply with, are consistent with the Coastal District policies and other ACMP standards. Our actual experience with these single agency reviews is limited, largely because there have been so few approved effective coastal management plans. So since the carve-out has been in effect, we've only sent out 11, what we call these project scope letters. So 11 times we've actually written to the local coastal district and said, hey, have you got any enforceable policies that would apply? And of those 11, one time we've actually conducted the ACMP review. So we don't have a lot of experience with that at this point. Obviously, as more and more coastal district plans are approved, we expect that there'll be a steep increase in both the number of project scope letters that we send to the districts as well as the single agency reviews that we conduct. So I'll stop there. That would kind of complete all I could really tell you about the single agency, our experience with the single agency reviews, Mr. Chairman, at this time. In terms of the effects of Senate Bill 161, the bill retains the part of the carve-out, the provision that the DEC environmental standards, as established by statute and regulation, are the sole enforceable policies of the ACMP for those purposes. But the bill eliminates the second part of the carve-out, such that no longer would simply our authorization of an activity establish that activity as consistent with the ACMP program. The intended effects of that change to us are unclear. You know, obviously we would continue to develop permits and other authorizations, but it would appear that the Coastal Policy Council would also be called on to determine whether permitted activities comply with state environmental standards. At least for projects in the coastal zone, the potential transfer of authority concerns us. It's state law.
Mr. Easton,
yes, sir.
A quick question. How, I think that's one of the questions that we do have is how are you going to make sure there's not a subjective issue when you approve these plans that are out there?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't understand.
You had stated that in order for some of these plans to be consistent, and this bill does away with that consistency, isn't there a subjective element of that that is what got us to where we are today?
The way at least I think about it, I mean, there are sort of two parts to consistency. There's a part of is a project or the project activities consistent with the DEC standards, air quality standards, sure. Water quality standards.
And that's the first factor.
That's our
And that's still in place with SB 161.
We don't read, and our attorneys don't advise us that way. That's the question. We actually read, and our attorneys advise that now this is no longer, while that standard remains, and there's a statement in statute to that effect, that the Coastal Policy Council now would also have say as to whether an activity complies with the state air quality standards, for example. And that's what worries us, or at least it's a question we have.
Okay, online we have Lindsay Walther. Ms. Walther, are you on for the Department of Law?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear. Do you have a comment to make on what was just testified by Mr. Easton?
I think that the part requires to look specifically at the proposed language. The bill that I have in front of me, it's page 11. And this...
Before you go on, Ms. Walther, can you just identify yourself just to make sure, and I'm assuming you're dealing with backslash C of the bill?
Yes, that's correct. And thank you for reminding me. I'm Lindsay Walther with the Department of Law.
Go ahead.
Okay, so top of page 11, you'll see in the bottom of page 10, we're talking about AS 4640-040B, which is the DEC carve-out. And if you look at the language of B, where it begins, I think this is what Mr. Easton was talking about, where DEC has the statutes and regulations as their exclusive enforceable policies of the ACMP. But then it, letter D, which is added at the towards the bottom of page 11, talks about to the extent that DEC doesn't cover certain projects that, let's see here, the coordinating agency shall review all project activities to ensure consistency with water, air or water discharges. And I think that's where the confusion is raised, is what does it mean to the extent that DEC doesn't cover the topic? And there's some confusion about, we're not sure what that means or how it would be interpreted. And I'm not sure if I'm addressing your question, but I think that is what Mr. Easton was referring to before. That's been the way we've read through this bill and consulted with DEC.
And Ms. Walser, that was my question. How subjective is that since there's not a clear interpretation?
To which part? I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I guess you are saying that the program has been subjective to date, correct?
Well, I think if there is confusion as to the interpretation of what Mr. Easton was alluding to, then that makes it a subjective issue. Is that not correct?
I guess I'm not understanding what the question is. I think our point was just, it's not clear what D does in relation to B. It seemed to be sort of at odds, where B says DEC has the and their statutes and regulations are the exclusive enforceable policies for the ACMP. But then D sort of opens up the scope of any review, saying that to the extent that those statutes and regulations don't apply, then all project activities will be reviewed to be consistent with statewide standards and enforceable policies, which are the local policies. And so there's a question about what that means and how that would be interpreted.
Mr. Easton, you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this would help. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit in my testimony because I really do.
Before you do that, then, we actually have a question from Senator Wagner.
Well, I don't know. I think he kind of got stopped in the middle of a comment, but it looked to me like where you were heading was with DEC's authority, and we put this coastal policy group back in. I think you're saying, in layman's terms, we're having conflicting or dueling groups because you might make a decision and then this group would have the authority to review that decision and take further action on your decision. Is that what you're saying, basically?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wagner, that's, yes, exactly.
And that is counterproductive to what we tried to do when we did this bill three years ago.
Senator Wagner, through the chair, the only caveat I would add is it's not entirely clear at this point that that's the effect. It's muddled, and we worry that that would be the effect, but it's just not that clear the way the bill's written as just a matter of statutory construct. So,
Senator Wagner.
That's when I read the bill, that's what I interpreted out of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Easton, continue.
I think for the sake of clarity, maybe I'll go back to kind of where I left off, if that's all right, Mr. Chairman. And
before we continue, Senator Thomas has a question or a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm confused as well. And as I read it and I read that Section D over and over, it appears to me that even though some might interpret it, and maybe it gets back to the Chairman's concern about subjectivity, is that it appears to me that either somebody has a lot of foresight and that they are looking forward to issues that may not necessarily be considered in those particular statutes that deal with predominantly the DEC, or that for whatever reasons they want to create confusion and allow it to get channeled back to the more local, to the communities and stuff as far as there. So I guess I'm scratching my head, and I'm not sure if that's a question or not, but is that not at least one interpretation that people were looking forward to things that may not necessarily have been covered, and that was the reason for putting this language in, that if it wasn't, that they still had the opportunity to participate in the process then?
Mr. Easton?
Or is that too far off base?
Senator, which could I ask which section you're referring to specifically? Are you talking about B or D?
I'm talking about small D, line 22 through 26 on page 11, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, here's our problem. I'll try to, it gets a bit complex, but let me do skip ahead and talk about Section 16, which is new subsection D. Before I do, let me point out that the state environmental standards typically allow some effect on resources. So our water quality standards allow some change in water quality. It's small, and it depends on the circumstances, but it's not a no-change standard. Same thing with our air quality standards, same thing in a way with spill prevention and response planning, in that those standards don't require absolute certainty that there'll never be a spill or that all spills could be cleaned up in their entirety at all times. It's not our standards allow some changes. When we read D, the new section D, what we are concerned about or what we wonder is whether it's a provision that says for the types of changes that would be allowed by state standards that the Coastal Policy Council is then required by D to actually look and see if those changes are going to comply with ACMP standards and enforceable district policies. So it provides both a second level of review as well as it invites the districts to develop standards that are air quality, water quality, that are more restrictive than the state standards. And again, sir, that's not a conclusion. It's just a question. It's not that clear to us, and it's a concern for us. So I don't know if that helps. I hope it does.
If I might just quickly, and, you know, but it appears to me that you're incorporating through to the extent that those particular statutes, areas of the statute, do not take into consideration some potential effect that you just have this policy or this procedure that you go through in it. It seems to me that it's incorporating existing statute into it, so it doesn't seem like it's necessarily challenging it. It would seem that unless somebody's trying to be real creative, that it does incorporate existing statute into it, and then just says in case that something that it was not anticipated pops up, we have this process to address it. Keeping it a little closer to home. Maybe I'm not stating it very well anyhow, and you should probably not try and answer my question anyhow, but that's what it appears to me, so I won't drag that out, and we can continue on, and you can finish your testimony.
Mr. Easton, do you have a comment on his a comment or question?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, I guess I would point out, I apologize if this is already clear to you, this reference to 4603.04.09.14 and D is a reference to the state statutes that underpin our state standard regulations. So we develop water quality standards pursuant to AS 4603. So this reference to 4603.04, et cetera, and the regulations adopted under those standards, that refers to state water quality standards, air quality standards, right. Contingency planning. I don't know if that helps or not. Maybe that was clear to you before, so I apologize.
If I may, yeah, that is my understanding. That's why I figured they were incorporated into the consideration already. So I guess that's why I'm confused, you know. But anyhow.
If you continue, Mr. Easton.
Mr. Chairman, returning to the effect of Senate Bill 161 and the loss of the DEC carve-out, it's probably clear that we continue to develop permits and other authorizations, but it appears that the Coastal Policy Council would also be called on to determine whether permitted activities comply with state DEC environmental standards. And I guess I've already said this, that potential transfer of authority concerns us. You know, DEC state law assigns DEC responsibility for interpreting and applying standards for air, land, and water quality. The application and interpretation of those standards requires expertise, and in many cases our decisions are subject to oversight by federal agencies with its staff of engineers and environmental professionals. DEC is well qualified as to serve as the sole arbiter of state environmental standards. We also strive to be consistent both in time and in area from one area to another, and predictable in how we interpret and apply those standards. In addition to involving the Coastal Policy Council in the process for determining compliance with DEC environmental standards, the bill has a second effect or a second potential effect, and that is, as a practical matter, it would require developing procedures to meld the DEC permitting process into the ACMP process. And I hear that discussed a lot as if maybe that was the sole effect of the bill, and again, we wonder about that. But this second result, that of bringing the DEC permitting process under the ACMP process without subrogating DEC authority to the Coastal Policy Council, seems possible, but it would require, we think, an amendment to the bill to accomplish that single result as opposed to both results, that of transferring power to the CPC as well as coordinating or bringing the DEC permitting process procedurally into the ACMP process. Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there in terms of specific effects on the bill, and maybe just mention a couple of other questions that the bill raises for us. I've been going on for some time here, and I'll try to shorten this. One thing the bill does when it eliminates the carve-out, it eliminates 4640.040b2, and that establishes that subpart, establishes the state environmental standards as the basis for judging ACMP consistency for activities in the OCS and the activities that are located elsewhere outside of state jurisdiction. So by eliminating that direct statement of what the standards are to be used in the OCS, at least creates a question of what standards are intended to be applied outside of state waters. And then I think I'll just conclude with that the bill to us appears that it may do much more than simply return activities authorized by DEC procedurally to the ACMP process. It raises questions as to the role of DEC and that of the Coastal Policy Council when it comes to the application of DEC statutes and regulations in the coastal zone, one. Two, it appears to invite the application of ACMP standards and local district policies that are different than DEC regulation and in all likelihood different from one coastal area to another. And then third, it removes the state environmental standards as a basis for determining coastal consistency in the OCS and creates an open question of what standards should apply there. And then just a final note, Mr. Chairman, if I may. You know, we acknowledge that there's concern that the coastal districts have been adversely impacted through changes in the ACMP process, and we recognize that concern as one that must be addressed. We believe in particular that there's opportunity for improving the procedural nexus between the ACMP process and the DEC permitting process, and we would welcome an opportunity with DNR to work on such improvements. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony. I have written testimony that I could leave with you if you'd, committee staff, if you'd like. Otherwise, I'd be happy to answer questions.
If you would, please, we'll go ahead and make copies for the rest of the committee members. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your testimony. Mr. Easton, and I know you hear the frustration that we hear from the communities, concerns about the change when House Bill 191 was adopted, and the concerns that they feel they no longer have a forum in which to participate, that they feel as if they don't have a seat at the table, that they can't comment on projects. And you've said very clearly that this is something that we must address, we must improve, we must work on it. So what would your recommendations be? How do we bring the communities back into this process more? And I assume you're presumed to be without giving them veto power over the department, but how do we bring the communities back into this process?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, that's a very good question. I'm not sure I know, but I guess I would defer to DNR, you know, as the lead for these sort of big questions about how to, you know, actually engage and improve the program. You know, our interest is pretty specific to the DEC carve-out. So with your permission, what I'd like to do is sort of defer that to DECOM Director Randy Bates. Otherwise, I don't know. It's a matter of, you know, simply working together. I do think that you've characterized our concern and interest correctly. I mean, we are interested in making sure that the districts feel like they have a seat at the table. And at the same time, we're very interested in not subrogating our final authority for interpreting and applying state environmental standards. So you certainly characterized our position correctly, and you ask a very good question. I wish I had a better answer.
Thank you, Mr. Easton.
Any further comments or questions, Senator Stevens? Mr. Easton, one of the questions that I have is that there seems to be a fear that the DEC standards are going to be have to come under the umbrella of the ACMP standards. Is there a conflict between the two standards, or why is there this underlying dread that you're going to be under those standards?
Mr. Chairman, that too is a good question. There certainly is no conflict now, because it's fairly clear under the current statutes that DEC standards are the policies, and there's no conflict there. There is concern that, and it goes only so far as that in certain areas the district may say we think the standard for zinc should be instead of 6.6 or something. I'm making those numbers up. I have no idea. I mean, we're concerned that could wind up with sort of a patchwork of different standards depending on which coastal zone you are in, that the standards might not be based on science to the extent that ours are. They're not subject necessarily to federal approval like our standards are, and that generally it would just not create a good standard regulatory regime. So I think that's our concern.
Any further questions, Mr. Easton, by any members of the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Bates, did you have anything that you want to say in relation to specifically maybe Senator Stevens' question? If not, fine. That's fine. We'll hold off on. Senator Wagner.
I'd like to have Mr. Bates come back up. I want to get a little bit of information from his last testimony.
Mr. Bates, if you would.
Good afternoon again. My name is Randy Bates. I'm the director of the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management within the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay. How many coastal zone management organizations are there in the state of Alaska now?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, there are 28 coastal districts that are actively participating in coastal management.
Of those, how many have submitted and been approved? And had their new plan approved?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, I'll give you some direct numbers here. There's a difference in how things are approved. I might have mentioned last time we have a federal granting agency, OCRM, within the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They have approval authority over any program changes that we make to our Alaska Coastal Management Program. There are 16 coastal district plans currently in effect. And if you're interested in the list of those, I'd be happy to run them down. They do affect some of your...
So, Mr. Bates, you're saying there's 16 plans that are approved?
There are 16 plans that are approved and in effect.
Okay.
Meaning if there's a project that is located within the coastal district or affecting the coastal district, those coastal districts can apply their enforceable policies to that act, to that project.
Senator Wagner, go ahead.
Okay.
There are 4 coastal district plans that were sent to OCRM.
So they're pending, right?
Well, not anymore. And this is to the question that you asked Marv Smith from the Lake and Peninsula Borough. The Kenai Peninsula Borough, Ketchikan, Kodiak Island, and Lake and Peninsula Borough, I just received notice from the federal agency, OCRM, this afternoon that they have approved those program changes. They have also approved the change in the lead agency for the ACMP. We transferred that from the former Project Management and Permitting Division to the new DCOM. So it was a package deal. They approved those 4 district plans. They approved the name change. Now what has to happen with those 4 plans is we file them with the Lieutenant Governor within the next week, or as soon as the district can get us their clean CD, and they go into effect 30 days after the Lieutenant Governor signs and files those.
So what we're talking about now in this long process we've gone through over the last 4 or 5 years, I think 5 years, this is the 6th year I've been here, it's 5 years, are 8 that have not been, have any of those 8 been submitted? Or are they still working to update?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, there is 1, Aleutians East, Bristol Bay CRSA, City and Borough of Juneau have all completed their plans and are pending submission to OCRM. It's pending submission because the districts have to clean up their plan, get it in final form before we can send it off to the federal granting agency. So those three are done through DNR review and approval, but waiting for submission to OCRM. The remaining five, which are Bering Straits Coastal Resource Service Area, the North Slope Borough, Northwest Arctic Borough, those three have chosen to mediate the decision of the DNR commissioner. The other two, Chenal-Urit Coastal Resource Service Area and Cordova, they're all approved. The last two, Chenal-Urit and Cordova, are going to be submitted to OCRM as well. But those last eight are pending submission to OCRM or mediation.
Senator Wagner?
I'd like a write-up on that.
I have got one for you, Senator Wagner, through the chair.
That's all.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would be happy to provide a copy of...
Mr. Bates, how long do you think that this, before these pending submissions are going to be taking place to the OCRM?
Mr. Chair...
What kind of time frame do you have for them?
For the five that are pending submission, that are not mediating, the time frame is largely their doing. They have to get us a clean CD. But as soon as we get a clean version of their plan, and the deal is they have to incorporate various changes that the commissioner recommended or approved, they have to submit a clean version to us so that we can submit a clean version to our federal granting agency. As soon as we get that, I think we turn that around probably in about 2 to 3 weeks, package it, submit it to OCRM, public notice it, and get that out. The federal granting agency, OCRM, has a 28-day review process, and they have typically in the past extended it by 2 to 4 weeks. So we're looking at 1 to 2 month federal review and approval process.
So you're talking about another year before it actually happens?
Mr. Chair, no. I'm talking about probably 2 to 3 months.
Okay.
Assuming the districts get us a clean plan today, this week, next week.
Two to three months?
That's correct.
And that was for CBGA?
That is for, Mr. Chair, that is for Aleutians East, Bristol Base Coastal Resource Service Area, City and Borough of Juneau, Chenal-Urit Coastal Resource Service Area, and Cordova.
Okay.
They're ready to go.
Okay. If you'll just hang on for a second. We have Terry Camry. Are you still on the line, Ms. Camry? She was on the line and had to do with the City and Borough of Juneau. I just wanted her to comment on it and what her understanding was of that. With that, are there any further questions, Mr. Bates? I want to thank you for coming on up this afternoon. And giving us this information. Senator Wagner still there?
Mr. Chair, you want me here?
Yeah, just wait there. I just want to wait till we see. We were just getting ready to dismiss Mr. Bates. I was wondering if you had any further questions, Senator Wagner.
No, this is all I need right here.
If not, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon on short notice. I know you weren't expected to speak, but you had some questions.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
With that, is there anybody else that wants to speak to Senate Bill 161? If not, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that we move this bill to the next committee of referral with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Any objection to moving it out of committee?
Yes, I object.
Okay, we have one objection. We'll have a roll call vote.
Senator Stephen?
Yes.
Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Senator Thomas?
Yes.
Senator Wagner?
No.
Chair Olson?
Yes. With that, I'm sorry?
4-1.
4-1, okay. With that, this bill moves from committee onto the next committee referral. thank you very much for those people that are testified on this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
And continuing sort of a discussion that I know we've moved it out, it seems to me it would be important to hear from the department. Is there some middle ground and a way to involve the communities? Because they've all expressed their frustration in not being at the table. And I realize this bill takes one point of view, whereas the department has taken another view. Is there some middle ground? And I'd appreciate that being presented to the next committee, the resource committee.
I think that's a good comment, Senator Kukish.
I think if there's middle ground, then there'd have to be some middle ground that other communities who are supportive of this bill would be appreciative of. Otherwise, I think that the department's had a lot of time to work on this, and the still communities are unsatisfied. So
absolutely.
It takes some convincing for me.
Just so you're aware of, Senator Stevens, I have not heard of any district that was satisfied with the HB 161. And if there was supposed to be some middle ground, I think that process should have been put in place a long time ago.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I can respond to that, I agree. I mean, we have heard enormous frustration from all the committees who have testified, but in your sponsor statement, you say, I think, unless I misread it, that you're not saying we should go back necessarily to the way things were. I mean, I think you said that, but that maybe there's something other than that, you know. So anyway, I just think we need discussion on it. And
absolutely. Senator Wagner?
Well, I understand that, and I understand some of the reasons. And, you know, if you take authority for permitting in certain areas away from local areas, I understand why they're upset, and that's one of the reasons they're upset. But at the same time, one of the reasons that was done is because people were having a lot of trouble getting permitting. And the reason I voted not to move this bill out of committee, I don't think any action should be taken on this bill, and it may be a large improvement. But until the districts do what they said they would do and get their plans through, reviewed and approved and accepted, and we got all 28 of them that have done that, then if we need to make some modifications, that's the time to make the modifications. But right now, we got some people who haven't even complied with the law yet, and we keep giving extension. I don't know how long we've extended it. I know for years and years and years. And I just get a little upset with the fact that these people delay and delay and delay, and my borough was one of them. But there comes a time when you do the work that you say you will do, and then after that, if there are problems and we see the problems, bring us to them, we work them out. But not until people have completed what they said they would complete. And that's my problem with a lot of things we do here. And I think that's the frustration we get into. We're talking about passing a new bill when there hasn't even been people haven't complied with the bill that's in place. It doesn't make sense to me that we do that. So I just want to put that on record.
Well, that's certainly a valid point, but as you look at and hearing from some of the people that are out there, the ability to go ahead and comply is almost impossible. And that's where the frustration came out of. And part of it has to do with the manpower and the problems that were pointed out by the department of hiring people that are out there, and they went back to other reasons of like letterheads that had to be redone, those kind of things. I'm saying we need to go ahead and do something in a timely manner so we have some way to regulate what's going on out there. Yesterday, we had a great big sale that went off on the Chukchi area, and people are upset up there because they didn't have any way to go ahead and have any influence about what was going on out there. And I realize it's in federal lands, but that's the reason for this bill. Because over the last 6 years, attempt after attempt by people that I have been in close contact with have been frustrated with what's going on here. And that's the reason I put this bill forward, so we can get some movement on it out there. We've got a letter here in my records that show that it's been signed by one of the directors that said he's not going to talk about regulation review for from a year from June 30th of 2008. I find that not just upsetting, I find that unreasonable. And that's the reason I put this bill forward, to get some movement out there.
But, Mr. Chairman, my point is that it's also frustrating on my behalf to sit, and I've worked on this a lot in resources, and it's very frustrating on my behalf to sit here and have the people say, well, we can't comply, we can't do this, we can't do that. I can come up with 1,000 different reasons why I can't do something. And sometimes it's a lot easier to do that than do the work that's requested of me and then look at it and see if it works or it doesn't work and then go from there. If it doesn't work, we do need to make some changes. Mm-hmm. That's
certainly a valid point, and I can't defend some of the actions that are out there. With that, let's go ahead and finish up, unless there's any further improper comments on Senate Bill 161. Thank you very much for participating. Next, we have Senate Bill 235, and we have Annie Carpinetti to go ahead and... We have Annie Carpinetti, who's in the audience. She is knowledgeable about the issue. Talis Kohlberg, Attorney General.
The Attorney General had to take off.
Okay.
I just want to make a statement for the record. I'm happy to have a bill in front of me I can support, yes, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, we are too.
Senate Bill 235, having to do with the alcohol local option leasing as well as its pertention to minors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for hearing this bill. My boss, Talis Kohlberg, was here and wanted to present it, but he had another appointment that he had to go to. But he did present it on the House side, and I'll try and repeat the things that he said about it in a brief way, because we have people online that we'd like for you to hear, if possible. There are three sources for Senate Bill 235. One is some recommendations that have not yet been adopted by the Rural Justice Commission. The second one, in regard to the underage drinking piece of this bill, is from a study that was done in the Hess department this last interim period, in conjunction with federal requirements and guidelines and recommendations for ways to limit underage drinking. And the third is an effort by the administration to support the local options that have been adopted by our communities to enforce at a higher level bootlegging in communities that have voted to adopt local options to restrict alcohol in their communities. And there are just six areas where this bill addresses, and I will describe them briefly, and then people will testify to explain, I hope, to you why it's important that these particular steps be taken. The first is the holdover from the Rural Justice Commission. It prohibits sending alcohol in response to written order to a local option community in plastic bottles. And the police and the Rural Justice Commission have agreed that it's fairly difficult for them to, it's much more difficult to detect alcohol that's being bootlegged in plastic bottles, because it's lighter, you can't hear it sloshing around, it's much more difficult to detect. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 really do one thing, and that allows, or it requires, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board to impose civil penalties on liquor licensees if their agents or employees, and this really has to do with bars and package stores, are convicted of furnishing alcohol to a minor. And this was a recommendation by the study on underage drinking to try and follow the lead of the tobacco enforcement. They have found that by having consequences on the owner of a store for their employee selling cigarettes to minors has greatly reduced the sale of cigarettes to minors, because the owners of the stores are paying more attention to what their employees do. And it is hoped that by having civil penalties on liquor licensees, they will emphasize more to their employees that it's against the law to provide alcohol to minors. In support of local option communities, the bill would adopt, right now, bootlegging is a Class A misdemeanor for smaller amounts. It's a Class C felony for larger amounts. This bill would provide that it would be a Class C felony if a person is convicted for a third time in 10 years of importing alcohol in smaller amounts in violation of a local option. We would also adopt mandatory minimum penalties for bootleggers that is almost exactly the same as the mandatory minimum penalties for drunk drivers, with one minor exception, and that is at the felony level, the look-back period for the third offense for a felony in this bill for bootleggers is 10 years. Current law is 15 years for drunk drivers. It also would change the manslaughter statute in our similar to a change that was made a couple years ago for methamphetamines, and it would provide that a person who bootlegged alcohol to a community in violation of a local option could be prosecuted for manslaughter if the person if a person who drank that bootlegged alcohol died as a direct result of drinking that alcohol. So it would have to be alcohol poisoning as a result of bootlegging the alcohol. It's similar to what you did with in terms of selling or providing methamphetamine to a person who died as a direct result of its ingestion. It would allow a person who is convicted of bootlegging or is charged with bootlegging to be eligible for referral to therapeutic courts, as are drunk drivers, people who are charged with drunk driving. It doesn't mean that they will go, but they will be eligible for consideration. And with that, I would like to, unless there are any questions of me, I would like to have Ms. Casto from Health and Social Services. I'm happy to answer questions. But
do I have any questions, Ms. Carpinetti, by the committee?
The one thing, and this may not be the correct place to talk about it, but then it may be. You know, I'm from the state of Washington years ago, a long time ago. And the one thing they had, and it always amazed me why they had it, and I'm starting to understand why they had it. They had, you didn't go into a Washington State liquor store and buy alcohol beverages unless you had a Washington State liquor ID card. I'm talking about driver's license. I'm not talking about other ID. To get that ID card, you had to be 21 years of age. If you went into that liquor store and didn't have one, you didn't buy liquor in that store. Now, they watch things a lot closer than we do, apparently. I don't know why that wouldn't help us in some of this. You know, I look at the violations for people buying underage people. There wasn't any underage purchase of alcoholic beverages from state liquor stores in the state of Washington. That's the way they handled it.
Through the chair, there is a bill in being considered. I think it's in Senate, the Senate Finance Committee now, that would help in that regard by requiring. Right now, there young people have horizontal driver's license, and adults have vertical. I think I just got it opposite, vertical and horizontal. But to make it easier for a clerk to read a driver's license and realize that the person who is trying to purchase is not an adult. Unfortunately. Right now, you can get a license when you're 20 years old. It'll last for 5 years, and it'll be vertical because you're a minor. And then when you're 22 or 23, you can buy alcohol with it, and it makes it tougher on people, on agents and employees of bars and package stores. So that would be similar to the Washington.
Not at all.
Not at all?
No, because in Washington, a driver's license is not a recommended identification in a liquor store.
And oh, I see. I misunderstood.
If you aren't 21, you can't go down and have your photograph taken and be issued a Washington State liquor card.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly a good idea and something
and
that should be considered.
A lot of people that are 21 in the state of Alaska don't necessarily have to have or have driver's license, mm-hmm. or they've lost it, had it taken away from them. Mm-hmm. So just a suggestion to throw out there. It may be something to consider to help some of this.
Thank you. That is a good suggestion, and I will take it to our DMV and various other people. Are there any other questions about what is in the bill?
Any further questions by the committee members, Ms. Carpenter? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a concern that I have is in the second paragraph, which reviews sections 2, 3, 4, and 5, I have a problem with holding other people responsible for another person's actions, I guess. And when I look at this and it says that it requires the ABC to levy fines and for a second or subsequent offense in a five-year period, suspend licenses if a bartender or clerk is convicted of furnishing alcohol to a minor on the licensed premises. So we're going to punish the owner for what a bartender does, maybe even a second bartender, you know. So I have a little difficulty with, I understand the problem, and I know it is a big problem, but trying to hold one person responsible for somebody else's actions is a difficult situation for me to to accept and understand, you know, even with the severity of the problem. You may be the straightest bar owner in the world and require this and even have people sign off that you've had lengthy discussions and this is the process that that they have to follow to actually serve alcohol, but then that person goes ahead and does it for their friends or whatever, and then I'm responsible, let's just say, for that person's actions. So,
Ms. Carpenetti?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I understand your concern, but the experience with tobacco enforcement has been pretty impressive in terms of how these civil penalties can affect the way an owner runs his or her business. And it is the owner or the licensee who sets the tone on how important enforcement of our alcohol laws are in our licensed premises. The reason that we suggested civil penalties were so that and they're graduated, so that the first time is a small penalty. I understand your concern, but it has worked. These penalties have worked really very, very well in tobacco enforcement, and the idea was another way to try and limit underage drinking in our state.
And just
Senator Thomas,
if I may, along the lines of my friend to my left here regarding a cards and more distinct ID related to that, has that been a consideration? We consider putting marks on driver's licenses, at least for people that have had DUIs. You know, it's not law now, but that's been considered. Is there consideration that the ID requirement of ID and the taking of that ID or the registration of that ID or something upon people entering the liquor stores or something along the lines of what the Washington State used to do, and I assume they still do?
I don't know if they still do it or not. No.
Through the chair, there was a long discussion for several years on that with a bill that recently passed with the marked driver's license, and it was a real struggle to get to the point where it passed, and at the point that it passed, it doesn't require licensees to check licenses, but it requires DMV to have the mark on the license. And I know that was a compromise reached by the sponsor and people who are running businesses in the state that sell alcohol.
Any further questions, Ms.
So Malcolm? I know that has been considered.
Ms. Carpenetti.
Just one quick comment. It would seem to me that would, you know, you don't want to just take the onus off the owner, sure, but if somebody has a fake ID, then that's one thing. That's a different set of circumstances versus somebody that doesn't have an ID or is not asked for one, I guess. So I guess if they were required to ask, that would be, and at least show that they had somehow been shown, which is always difficult too. That would make a difference to me as well. But
unfortunately, that was one of the problems with the bill that passed last year, is that the generally licensees did not want to have to ask everybody. They just wanted to have to ask, is my understanding of that process.
Ms. Carpenetti, the questions I have is that somebody is traveling with checked luggage and they're carrying alcohol. Do they have to go ahead and have it in plastic containers as well?
The plastic containers applies to licensees sending in response to written order to a rural community. It doesn't apply to individuals who are bringing them out for personal use.
Okay. And if somebody is sending something from their private cellar, like homemade wine or something like that, does that have to be in plastic?
According to the bill, it's people who are sending to a rural area, a licensee sending to a rural area.
Okay.
So it would not apply to an individual bringing a bottle of wine.
Senator Wagner, you have a comment on that?
No.
I think we'd like to know more about that.
Here, tell us more.
Senator Kukesh.
I was just wondering if you were going to send us something.
I stopped.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That was 4 years ago I stopped doing that.
We'll buy some plastic bottles for you.
Well, I appreciate the efforts. Thank you very much, Ms. Carpenetti.
Thank you.
Diane? Ann Castle. Come up, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Diane Casto. I'm the manager of prevention and early intervention services for behavioral health within the Department of Health and Social Services. And I'm here today to talk about this bill and the support of the Department of Health and Social Services. As the manager for prevention and early intervention services, one of the main issues that I deal with is prevention of substance use and abuse of substances. And with that, while we work with all ages, of course, the primary age that we work with in order to stem the tide of later alcohol abuse is to work with youth and the underage drinking issues. As Ms. Carpinetti discussed, we have over the last year been working on a project, and I believe you all have a copy in your files of the State of Alaska Plan to Reduce and Prevent Underage Drinking. If you don't have them, I'll be happy to supply them for you. I thought you did have them. And this development of this plan, which is currently out and open for public comment, we released it in December of this year in conjunction with a visit to Alaska by the Acting Surgeon General in relation to a call to action that the Surgeon General also put forward last year. So the Surgeon General came to Alaska for the Alaska Health Summit. We released the plan for underage drinking, to prevent underage drinking, not to encourage it, and we now have it open for public comment. So our movement in this area was based on some of the national movement in this area as well, with the recognition that there was an awful lot of underage drinking going out around nationwide. In 2002, the Institute of Medicine and the National Research Council put together a national strategy that actually came out in 2004 called Reducing Underage Drinking, a Collective Responsibility. This document, as well as the Surgeon General's call to action to prevent and reduce underage drinking, helped us in the development of our plan, state plan. And all of the research and all of the committees that have been working on this in the last few years, one of the main issues that they address is access to alcohol. And while we recognize that all access to alcohol is not through vendors, is not through stores or sellers of alcohol, there's also home, you know, parents or kids taking things out of the parents' refrigerator or wine cellar, we certainly recognize that, and that's a whole other issue. But one of the areas where youth do get alcohol is through liquor stores and purchasing in that manner. So we have, and in our plan, the issue of higher penalties for retailers has been a very critical one. And that is as part of why we are supporting this bill. And let me just give you a little bit of data just to give you a perspective of drinking by youth in Alaska. And the data I'm going to talk with you about is from the biannual Youth Risk Behavior Survey. It's a cooperative survey that's done it's a CDC survey, and it's done by the Department of Education and Health and Social Services Public Health. We just had the 2007 results back, and the good news of this is that we are starting to see a decline, that in almost all of the categories related to substance use in Alaska, we have seen declining numbers. Not huge declines, but a little bit. 73.6% of students, this is grades 9 through 12, reported having had their first drink of alcohol. reported having had at least one drink of alcohol one or more days during their lifetime. This is by 9th through 12th grade, that 73% have had some level of drinking at that point. 20.4% of students reported having had their first drink of alcohol other than a few sips before age 13. One of the things we know from research is that the rates of lifetime dependence on alcohol decline from more than 40% among individuals who start drinking at age 14 or younger to roughly 10% adult dependence for those who start drinking at age 20 or after. So it's critical when kids start drinking as to what their lifetime dependence will be. 39.7% of students reported having had at least one drink of alcohol on one or more of the past 30 days, and 25.8% of students reported having had five or more drinks in a row on one or more occasion. That's what we consider binge drinking. So 25%, almost 26% of our students are binge drinking, and probably most often on weekends. 9.7% of high school students reported driving and drinking at least once in the past 30 days. Now, again, most of these numbers have gone down a little bit, 1 or 2 percentage points. But for me, as a mother of two now adults, in fact, this is actually fortuitous in that my son's 21st birthday is today, and he's in Las Vegas with two of his male friends. So I called him earlier to make sure everything was okay. little mother nervousness here, but so far so good. But I think what this is telling us is that we do have a problem, and if we have over 70% of our children, grades 9 through 12, who have started drinking, that's a problem, and we need to find ways to curb that. So some of the other things that influence drinking or influence the work that we're doing, yes, I'm sorry.
Ms. Castro, Senator Wagner.
How does that compare on the national scale?
Through the chair, again, in many things, we are always the highest in the national, among the national level. We do not yet have the 2007 YRBS national data. They're putting it together right now, and we'll have an actual comparison very soon. But in comparison to the 2005, we are a little bit below the national average, which is good. And it is an issue we've been working on for some years, so hopefully we're starting to see some progress
in
the area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. Can you tell me what the source is for the alcohol for these 73% and 24% of these kids? Is that part of the statistic as well?
Through the chair, I wish I could. Unfortunately, in the YRBS, there is not a question that asks them where they purchase the alcohol, so we don't have that specific information. We do have that question in the YRBS for cigarettes, and it lists a whole, you know, did you buy them at a store? Mm-hmm. Did you get them from a friend? Did you get them from your parents? Did you steal them? Did you? So we have that for tobacco, but we do not have it for alcohol. But another thing, and I believe you have this as well, which might at least help in some of looking at this. Did you get copies of the charts related to tobacco and mm-hmm. Cynar? If you look at this chart here, it's the Alaska high school youth who bought their own cigarettes. Oh, sure. And this, again, this is tobacco, and this is where we do have a question in the YRBS for tobacco and where they obtained it. In 1995, 27% of the youth were purchasing tobacco at a store. In 2003, it had dropped to 12%. We changed our laws related to penalties for selling tobacco to a minor in 2002. So we saw a significant drop in how many youth were buying at the store. And in 2007, only 3% were actually purchasing them at the store. So I don't know that we can relate those exactly, but I do know that what we're seeing from increased penalties over tobacco, we have seen a drop in their ability to purchase at the store. And I wish I did have that data, but it's not one of the data points we collect.
Would it not be a wise idea? Because then it could help you, you know, pinpoint, you know, what you want to do and how you want to spend your resources and effort, I guess.
Yes,
so, anyhow.
Through the chair, and let me just make a quick comment on that. We do work very closely with public health, who is the one who works on the state's YRBS, and we, because it is a CDC survey, we can add new questions, but we have to go through a process, and we have been discussing adding that question.
Before we go any farther, we're past 5 o'clock, and can people stay here for a little while longer so we can try and move this bill along, or are people going to have to leave before we get a chance to move it out?
Depends on how
Let me see what our testimony is.
Okay.
A few minutes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay.
We've got four more people to testify, just so you know.
I will move quickly through my testimony. In fact, I'm going to not go with that, except that just to say that, and I know that you all know this, alcohol and youth is a lethal combination. And so it not only affects just the youth and their drinking and their future drinking habits, but it also impacts suicide rates. In Alaska, the highest suicide rates that we have, and this is unlike the national rates, is that it's our youth, 15 to 24. Those are the highest rates of suicide for the state of Alaska. The national rates are much older. It is not the youth who are committing suicide. We also know that in the state of Alaska, 43.7% of all suicides involve alcohol or drugs. So we know that alcohol is mixing with youth who are having a bad day and oftentimes ending up in suicide. And again, youth are impulsive. Alcohol just increases that impulsivity. We also know that we have an awful lot of youth who are driving and drinking, and accidents, both just critical injuries as well as fatalities. So we need to keep remember this. And a lot of youth are ending up in our juvenile justice system related to alcohol, and I believe Pat Lehman is online to talk about the juvenile justice impact. Just you know, the three things that are really that we believe are going to impact underage drinking in Alaska on from this bill is the first thing is there the development of a statewide system to track minor consuming citations. Currently, they are kept kind of sporadically in the court system, but there is not one source where someone can go, a judge or a probation officer or a treatment facility, to find out how many minor consumings a youth has had. So they may go into court and the judge thinks it's their first minor consuming, but indeed it could be their fourth or fifth. So one of the things this bill will do is to add a tracking system, which will really give us a better handle on how many youth there are, where they are in the system, how many repeat offenders we have, and make sure we're getting the appropriate intervention, whether it be education or treatment. We also believe this will reduce access to alcohol from retailers and servers of alcohol by increasing penalties, which we've talked about. There is a comparison of the tobacco penalties that we currently have, which are very effective. And again, I will say we have the most stringent tobacco penalties in the country. We admit that, and we're actually quite proud of it because it has significantly reduced the sale of tobacco to our youth, which you can see in this chart. So we believe that it has helped, and we believe holding both the clerk and the owner responsible has been one of the critical elements of making the tobacco laws successful. We also believe that the other piece that has made the tobacco law successful is that there is a consistent and mandatory penalty. Currently with the alcohol penalties, there is not a mandatory penalty and they're not consistent. They can kind of be negotiated this way or that way. So oftentimes there's no penalty at all. So we believe a consistent penalty and some mandatory penalty is what has helped our tobacco laws and our reduction in youth access to tobacco. And then the final thing that we believe this bill will impact is by putting more emphasis on and helping control access in our damp and dry communities, that it helps reduce access for our youth as well, because they are getting that alcohol just as well as the adults are that is coming into those communities. And if we believe if a community has voted to keep their community dry or damp, that there should be laws that help enforce them and help them make that happen in their communities. So I will conclude with that. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, or if there's any other material I can get you to help, I would be happy to do that.
Senator Wagner.
Yeah, one question on this chart.
Yes.
I was going through that earlier. Why are the proposed penalties for clerks so much greater, I'm talking about the alcohol, than the proposed penalties for the licensee and the business owner? That just doesn't.
Through the chair, for the clerks, there are no proposed changes for the clerks in these two categories. They are what is in current law. Because you see those two columns are the same, the current and the proposed. The changes in the alcohol comes in making the business owner also part of the responsibility.
Well, to me, the business owner should be the primary responsible person. And if I'm a business owner and I'm selling tobacco and alcohol, I would think the penalty for me allowing a clerk in my employment to do that would be much more stringent for me than for the clerk. I mean, they're paying these clerks $8 to $10 an hour, and for God's sakes, we've got a penalty. The first offense is, $10,000 and a year in jail, and within 5 years, then it's 5 years and $50,000, and you look down here at the penalties for the licensee and the business owner, and it's much smaller than that.
This is Annie Carpinetti, and I just want to respond quickly. Current law for the clerks and the agents is not going to be changed. This bill will impose the only penalties on the licensee and the owner of the business. Right now, there are no penalties for the owner or the licensee of the liquor license. So this bill would make it a little bit more rational.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we need to hold on to this bill for a while. Maybe we need to make it a little more stringent.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, could I also make one comment on that?
Sure.
The other thing that going back to mandatory, some kind of mandatory penalty, one of the things that this also that we know in the current alcohol penalties is they are not mandatory. And I actually asked the question about, so it says up to 1 year and up to $10,000, and I asked what is the normal that the normal penalty that would occur for a clerk, and what I was told, and I had it written down, I don't think I have it right in front of me, but it was maybe some community service hours or a suspended penalty. So in most cases, they're not getting much of a penalty at all. And I believe Ron Taylor is online, who is with the Alcohol Safety Action Program and works very closely with this issue and actually helped me put this chart together. So he might be able to respond to that as well.
Well, let me explain to you in the state of Washington. I hate to go back to the state of Washington. I'm not an expert in this. But my son and daughter-in-law owned a sports bar in the state of Washington. Their laws were so stringent that if they had a violation of drugs on premises, alcohol served to a minor, or tobacco served to a minor, they lost their license. It wasn't any suspension. Their license was gone. And so I don't think we're very stringent at all.
So, Senator Wagner, do you want to amend the bill?
Well, I might consider it, and I think we need to, and I'm not going to amend it today, but I think maybe we do need to review this a little further, and I'd like to meet with you and you too, and maybe talk about some of this because, and I understand some of the problems between the owner because of the size of stores and everything else, but I still kind of, I think we need to look at it a little more.
You're not in judiciary, are you?
No.
Ms. Castro, any further comment? Any further questions of Ms. Castro? Senator Thomas.
Just one, if I can remember it after previous comments. What was I looking for here? I was looking at one of your charts, and now I've forgotten what it was. Oh, I guess how you confirmed the data for the tobacco sales.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, are you talking about the completed sales? Or are you talking about where the youth?
Your
purchased?
Chart where it shows the percentage of Alaska vendors found selling tobacco. How that information was gathered?
Okay, it's a very complicated process. No. we have a responsibility to the federal government. We receive the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services. Substance Abuse and Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. It's a grant that we get, every state gets every year, and we get about $4.6 million. Part of the requirements for getting that grant is that we have to do an annual SINAR inspections and SINAR compliance for tobacco sales to minors. SINAR, Mike SINAR was a U.S. senator a number of years ago who put this forward. That's why it's called SINAR. So each year we have to go out and do compliance checks. We have three investigators who work with student interns who we hire and train to go out and do buys. Go out. They have their ID. They are between the ages of 15 and 17, and they go out with an inspector who usually kind of stays in the background. They go up and they ask to purchase cigarettes. So that's how we get the data. We then calculate how many retailers we went into. We do a stratified sample across the state, so we're doing rural and urban, and then we calculate how many sales related to how many vendors we approached.
So they have an ID, but does the ID say that they are of the age to buy tobacco or that they're not?
Well, it's their own ID, so, and they're all underage because in Alaska you can't buy tobacco until you're 19.
Right.
So they go in with their own ID. And again, most of our youth are around 16. Yeah. And we actually have very strict requirements also about how they dress. And, you know, the boys can't have hair, facial hair. They have to be clean shaven because we don't want to try and trick anybody. Sure. We want them to look their age.
That's good.
So, and just if you are more interested, we do an annual SINAR report. We have just, in fact, today sent in the final amendments to our 08 report, federal fiscal year 08 report, and I could certainly get that to you, which gives
you all
that.
Okay. I just wondered the process, okay. You know, and I know the state police do the same thing in bars and
yes.
stuff, too. So, anyhow, mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further questions, Ms. Casto? No, thank you very much. Sure. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thank you. I was just reading through the letter from Tawarik. I think it's, I'm not sure who the writer is. Loretta Bullard. And she brings up the issue of waiters and waitresses. Why are we not including waiters and waitresses in this, as well as clerks?
Through the chair, they are included. It would be... And we probably just use the term clerks, but it is anyone who sells to a minor. So it can be servers as well as clerks in the store.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Sells or serves.
Sells or serves. That's correct.
Any further questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we have Sue McLean online, the Deputy Attorney General. Ms. McLean, are you still on?
I am, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
You're coming in loud and clear, ma'am.
Okay, and I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, I'm actually the Chief Assistant Attorney General for the State Criminal Division, and I'm here today to talk to you actually in my capacity of having spent years as a prosecuting attorney, and I want to address my comments to that portion of the bill that talks about importation of alcohol into communities that have exercised a local option. I've worked as a prosecutor for the state on and off since 1981. I've tried cases. I was a long time in Kodiak. I've tried cases in Kodiak, Kenai, Anchorage, Haines, Skagway, Juneau, Wrangell, and Bethel. And I was the DA in Bethel 10 years ago, came back to work for the state a little more than 2 years ago to start a rural prosecution program because the primary purpose of that program was to assist our attorneys who are out in Western Alaska because the crimes they have are so much more serious than anyone else's crimes. And I can tell you, and I do tell you coming from that experience, that those villages and towns out there that have elected to keep alcohol from their community have done that purposefully and knowingly, and I must say that the violent crime I've seen coming out of those places when people get alcohol into them is much more violent than anywhere else in the state. Probably what's most tragic about it is that it's typically directed at another family member or someone in a small community whom you know very well. So it's a tragedy all around. There isn't any stranger jumping out of the bushes or drive-by shooting. And the penalties, I want to turn, and I, you know, anecdotally, I mentioned this in the House. Since I've been back, and just those few cases that I've been asked to help with in the capacity of a rural prosecutor, of those two involved young people who were intoxicated, threatening to shoot themselves and wound up shooting their parents. One involved someone chasing a VPSO, an unarmed peace officer, with an axe. I don't think those things would have happened if it weren't for alcohol. And I don't. While that's not technically a defense, it certainly would be unreasonable or unrealistic to say that alcohol played no part in those things. Alcohol plays a large part in almost every crime I've seen in Western Alaska. I also want to mention that just yesterday a case came down from the Court of Appeals. It was a memorandum opinion, and it was kind of delightful in that, of course, we can never, we're always in a position not being able to ask the bootleggers how much they're charging to bring the alcohol in or the people who are buying how much they're paying to bring the alcohol in, because they both have a privilege not to tell us that, because they'd be talking about, you know, committing crimes. But this particular case, in this particular case, the defendant's name was, I'm going to catch it here, Mr. Horner. includes a transcript of a tape recording with Mr. Horner as some of the airport officers spoke to him on the tarmac at the Fairbanks Airport, and he very casually told them that he had these bottles of R&R whiskey, 750 milliliter bottles, which is about a pint and a half. He was taking them out to the village and going to sell them for $150 each. And I tell you from prosecuting cases, I know that's the going rate, if not more. The bootleggers are making a business decision. They're making a business decision because the truth of the matter is that the first time that they're caught, the likelihood that they're going to serve any time is nil. That's probably true the second time they're caught as well. While the villages are busily passing laws, trying to keep their villages dry, trying to keep the tragedy of alcohol from the families in their village, I cannot describe for you what it is like to stand in a courtroom where a brother has killed another brother, where a sister has this happened, tied the house, shut the door of her brother's house with he, his wife, and their children inside, and attempted to burn it down. When she's brought into court the next morning, she can't even believe she did that. And, of course, there's so many conflicting emotions. The people don't remember doing it. The families love both the victim and the offender. The idea that they should have chosen to have their village be dry and have that enforced is absolutely something that people in the rest of the state, I think, should do everything we can to support. And one of the ways we can support that is by making that business decision that the bootlegger is making a little more expensive, a little harder, knowing that you'll go to jail, knowing that the third time you get caught bringing in even a small amount, you're going to have a felony, knowing that if someone drinks themselves to death, we're going to hold you criminally responsible. That puts the bootlegger in touch with the consequences of what for them is simply a business. I want to come back finally to that case that came down yesterday because it was so typical. The man standing on the tarmac, he's telling the airport police officer, who says, "What are you doing?" And the man says, "Oh, I'm just doing some importing." "Well, how much are you going to get for those?" $150 each. It's R&R whiskey. It probably cost him no more than $10 a bottle. "How many do you have?" 76 bottles. That's $11,000. There's no reason that a person wouldn't bootleg if they know they're not going to jail and they're going to get $11,000 for six cases of alcohol. So that's what I have to say today to the senators, and I'm open for any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions, Ms. McLean, by any members of the committee? Thank you very much this afternoon for coming out. We have two more people to testify, and we'll have Matt Felix come up and testify, if you would, please. Mr. Felix, identify yourself for the record, and we've got two more behind you.
Okay.
We're going to try and get out of here by 5:30.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll make it fast. My name is Matt Felix. I'm director of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence here in Juneau, and I'm head of the legislative committee for the State Directors Association. We are the people in trenches treating the individuals that are addicted or abusing alcohol. This is my 36th year in this occupation, and eight of those years were spent as state director of the Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse when the state had a division. During those years, I assisted Senator Binkley in developing local option and implementing local option and refining it over three pieces of legislation. And for that section of the bill, I would just say in conjunction with my colleagues that we support this bill and that section of the bill. Anytime you can tighten up local option, then we certainly agree with it. It's been very effective in rural Alaska over the last 20 years. It's certainly, there's three major studies that's been done about the effectiveness of local option. Two in Barrow, done by Public Health Service, both show dramatic reductions in a variety of health and social related ills when local option is in place. Barrow was a perfect spot because they went dry, they went wet, they went dry, so you could do some wonderful research on that. The third one is anecdotal in Selawik, same thing. They went dry, they went wet. the troopers kept track of the data out there, and it's dramatic, and I can get you those studies if you like. The other section of the bill that we support is the enforcement, and Senator Wagner, I, through the chair, I certainly support your views on enforcement, and I think Washington State does it right, and we haven't done it right yet. I think you're absolutely right. If I had anything criticism of this bill, it would be that the licensee, who is the responsible person, who is licensed, they are not certified, they are not selling bread and milk, they are selling a product that has potential harm, should know the regulations and the statutes around that license and be responsible, and therefore if they don't follow those statutes and regulations should suffer the consequences of such through penalties, and they don't. And I think this bill is a little light on that area, and I totally agree with you on that. And the other thing is enforcement that's beefed up in this bill with a physical note, and I thoroughly, enforcement is prevention. And we all talk about prevention. The medical community talks about prevention of any disease. Legislature, I've been up here a number of years to testify, they all talk about prevention in different health areas. Enforcement is prevention in this area. The more you enforce Title IV, which, by the way, is a statute that's came into being with statehood. Some of the statutes, as you see, they're outdated. And really, we need to take a look at Title IV. And this bill takes a good look at parts of Title IV and certainly needs updating. But the rest of Title IV needs to be reviewed as well. But this bill certainly does a good part to updating those sections in Title IV.
Well, any further any questions of Mr. Felix? Mr. Felix, thank you very much for hanging in there with us.
Thank you.
This afternoon. Next, we'll go offline to Bethel. We have Patricia Lehman on the line. Ms. Lehman, are you on, please?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
You're coming in loud and clear.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Pat Lehman, and I'm Deputy Director of Operations for Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Juvenile Justice. I want to thank you for taking up this bill and giving some serious attention to the issue of alcohol, particularly in our rural areas. As you mentioned, I'm calling from Bethel, Alaska, which is where I live and work. And I'm sure you're well-versed at this point on the impact that alcohol abuse is having on rural Alaska and Alaska's kids. I've witnessed a fair amount of this myself during the last 19 years living and working in Bethel. 18 of those years, I worked as superintendent of the Bethel Youth Facility, which is a juvenile detention and treatment facility serving Bethel and the surrounding villages. Most of my comments will be related to my experiences in that position and as a resident of this region. When youth drink, their judgment and their ability to control their actions is even further reduced. And their understanding of the consequences of their actions frequently becomes muddled. Our staff in DJJ estimate that between 50 and 80% of all the crimes that we see committed by juveniles involve alcohol in some way, whether the youth are intoxicated when they commit an assault or they try to break into someone's house to steal their liquor. In addition to committing crimes, youth who are drinking also make themselves vulnerable in a lot of ways. As mentioned previously, they're vulnerable to suicide, and they're easy targets for rape, sexual abuse, and assault, among other things, when they're intoxicated. It's not unusual to see girls who've been so intoxicated when they were raped that they have no recollection of the incident even happening. And the families of many of these youth are also devastated by the effects of alcohol. As Ms. McLean stated more eloquently than I could have earlier, these families are devastated. We have, I've seen in my tenure, beginning when I came to Bethel as a probation officer 19 years ago, youth who came to the attention of juvenile justice who could not identify one single sober adult in their families with whom they could be placed. That was true then, and that remains true today. The cause and effect is clear. The more readily alcohol is available to young people, the more likely they are to commit crimes. And the more we can limit the access to alcohol, the more we can hopefully limit the crimes that they commit because they're intoxicated or addicted. To give you an idea of the significance of the alcohol problem with young people in this area, There were 521 minor consuming alcohol referrals to the Bethel District Attorney's Office from January 1st of 2007 to October 11th of 2007. That 521 MCA referrals represented 25% of all misdemeanor referrals and 20% of total referrals during that time. This bill does a lot of different things to help keep alcohol out of the hands of young people, making alcohol less accessible to the youth in the YK Delta would make a tremendous difference in the lives of the young people in Bethel and in the surrounding villages. As Ms. Casto mentioned earlier, probably the most useful thing from our perspective in juvenile justice in this bill is in seeking to establish a tracking mechanism for minor consuming alcohol cases. Currently, when an individual is cited for underage drinking or possession, the justice system has no indication as to the number of times that a youth has been cited previously, or information to indicate whether the young person has complied with the education or treatment requirements that were set. This became apparent to us in Bethel when, in 2006, a number of community agencies got together and formed a minor consuming alcohol task force. At that time, youth were being referred as first-time MCA, minor consuming alcohol offenders, multiple times, as there was no system in place to track previous convictions. For the local police to be able to determine how to appropriately charge a young person for consuming alcohol, their only real system for doing that was to contact the dispatch officer and ask that person to look through a stack about 4 inches thick of prior convictions that were hanging on a clipboard in the police station. And sometimes the police didn't receive these documents at all from the court, and sometimes the dispatcher was unable to locate the document, even if it was there. Consequently, the police would end up charging the youth as a first-time MCA offender. After undertaking a fairly painstaking data collection effort that looked back at youth convicted of MCA in 2006, we learned that 52% of youth in court in Bethel for a third MCA were actually convicted instead as first-time offenders rather than third-time offenders. So, in other words, 14 out of those 27 youth who should have received a third MCA conviction were instead convicted as first-time offenders. One youth had 6 MCA offenses and was, on the 6th offense, again convicted as a first-time offender. Bethel now has a better tracking system in place, and youth are being charged more appropriately. This bill lays the groundwork for an improved system of tracking these minor consuming offenses statewide, hopefully resulting in a coordinated approach across agencies working with these youth to monitor and report on the outcomes associated with a minor consuming offense. Speaking from Bethel's experience, youth seem to be taking MCA charges more seriously now that they see these charges being treated more seriously by the justice system. And along with that, youth who don't comply with the conditions set for them as a first-time offender are subject to the increased penalties provided for subsequent offenses and more likely to receive the treatment that many of them desperately need. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'd be happy to stay online and try to answer any questions that you might have.
Do we have any questions of Ms. Lehman by members of the committee? If not, I want to thank you very much for standing with us this afternoon, Ms. Lehman, and appreciate your testimony as well as your 19 years of experience out there in Bethel. You must have a special
You're
calling.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Okay. One thing I would like to do is to go ahead and ask for unanimous consent for the committee to authorize legislative legal to redraft Senate Bill 235, version 25-Gulf Sierra 2035/A, because it needs to conform to the drafting manual. Apparently there's a problem with that. Is there a problem with sending this back to...
It'll just happen when they... when we send the bill through, but you do have to ask for consent from the committee to have it redrafted.
We have unanimous consent for that.
You got my vote.
Senator Thomas?
For it to be redrafted?
It,
just be redrafted into legislative
in,
format
in conforming
rather than
with
Department
the,
of Law.
Because it was it came from the Department of Law.
Yeah.
Senator Stevens, I'm assuming that's a yes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. With that, with unanimous consent, we'll go ahead and accept that reauthorization or the authorization to have legal redraft this issue. Just before we go ahead and vote, do you have any final comments, Ms. Carpinetti, since you're the prime person on this bill?
Just thank you for, I understand there was a question by one of the senators, which I'll attempt to answer.
Senator Thomas.
Yes, I had a question too, the application of it, and I looked at the sectional analysis, so I guess I understand that sections, at least the ones that concern me, sections 2, 3, 4, and 5, hold the owner of the license responsible for their agent, so to speak. And I find that, like I said before, that concerns me. That would seem to be no different than holding the Commissioner of Public Safety responsible for all of the actions of and subject to the same sanctions or criminal activity that might be performed by one of their personnel. And I don't see that happening. I hate to be dramatic about it, but there have been many police officers charged with things, and I just mention it here. I see that no different than holding a bar owner responsible for their bartenders when they may not even be on the premises. So I'm a little concerned with the penalties that are given for somebody holding somebody else responsible for their actions. As I said before, I have a problem with that aspect of the bill.
I guess one of the questions we have Senator Wagner on one end of the spectrum, right, wanting to hold them there, and have Senator Thomas on the other end.
That's right.
Senator Wagner has elected not to go ahead and give it an amendment. Are you interested in giving an amendment?
I would. I know you want to move this forward. I understand that part of it is dealing with particularly the problems in the bush, which it was indicated that is the more serious end of it. And I realize that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't have problems in the urban areas. I guess my objection is to what takes place to licensees that do make a good attempt to control something. But this is twice in a 5-year period of time. That's a pretty long period of time to actually make sure that every person that works for you does not somehow violate a law. You're being held responsible in some cases for 30 or 40 people that are employees. And I just find that a little bit severe. So I guess if I were to amend it, I don't know that I'd be prepared to do it today, but I don't want to necessarily hold the thing up. But I would certainly temper
certainly
that.
Certainly have that option of holding it. We'll wait for your amendment if you want to come forth with an amendment.
That would be fine, sure. If you're willing to do that,
we will go ahead and hold the bill then. When's this?
We won't be able to hear it until the 19th.
We won't be able to hear it until the 19th. Okay. Okay.
Maybe that would be fine. I don't know if judiciary's response to it, but I just that bothers me. Being held, I would not want to be held responsible for some of my employees' actions.
Sure.
You know,
through the chair. Could I just make one I just want to make
Ms.
it clear that this
ahead.
Is this is a civil penalty. It's not a being responsible criminally for the acts of another person. It's the third offense in a period of just 5 years. The look back is only 5 years in this particular case. I don't know whether that alleviates your concerns. And I would say to Senator Wagner, that's these two divergent positions is why we came up with what's in the bill.
Well, I read it to say levy fines and for a second or subsequent offense in a 5-year period, suspend license.
It's a 7-day license suspension for second, and it's a 30-day for third and subsequent in the bill. So it the second is 7 days, the third is 30 in a 5-year period.
We will go ahead and hold the bill then for a subsequent amendment by Senator Thomas.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for staying late. And this meeting is at
Next Tuesday,
which is February 12th. With that, we're adjourned.